Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony Lowenstein is a Sydney-based journalist who has written for publications around the world, including The Guardian, Haaretz, The Nation, Sydney Morning Herald, and many others. His 2009 best-selling book, My Israel Question, is a dissenting Jewish view on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. His 2008 book, The Blogging Revolution, is about the internet in repressive regimes. He is currently working on a book about disaster capitalism in Australia and across the world. He's a media spokesman for the campaign to defend WikiLeaks. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this WikiLeaks thing is major, major big. Why don't you talk about what you think it really means? I mean, I see it as a revolution in a way, changing the fact that governments now can't hide. What's your take on it?
There's so many things to say, isn't there? I think one of the things that I've written a lot about in the last few weeks and spoken a lot about is how it changes the relationship between the state and the media. The problem has, I think, been for many, many years in the mainstream press that there is a very unhealthy, cozy relationship between governments, between ministers, here and overseas, between officials, media spokespeople and journalists. And so when, for example, most people in the media see leaks or so-called big stories on the front page of the paper, most of the time those stories are sanctioned leaks. They are basically some media advisor giving some journalist a story and therefore everyone thinks it's a great scoop. Mostly it's not. It's someone being spoon-fed. What WikiLeaks does, I think, in many ways is change that and challenge that because it actually suggests that there are individuals out there, Julian Assange, who's the founder of WikiLeaks, and people who leaked him the information. People often forget that he's not the one who actually got the, he's the leaker. He was given information by, we think, Bradley Manning, who is a low-level U.S. intelligence official from Iraq, who's now sadly in a jail in the U.S. And I think one of the things that it does do is that Julian Assange is an outsider. He's not a player. He's not someone who has spent many, many years working to make contacts in the media. He's someone who challenges that cozy relationship. And I think you've seen in the last few weeks, but also I think in months past, many in the media resent how WikiLeaks operates because they didn't get the leaks or they weren't the ones who had the relationship. So that's, I think, one change in that dynamic between the media and the state. I think in the other major sense is, of course, that the reality of how our governments operate, which many people presumed or thought, is now revealed in very clear black and white.
When you say our government, you mean the Australian and the US government?
Indeed, many governments. I mean, in these recent documents, there's information from about countless countries, Central Asia, the US, Australia, parts of Asia, the Middle East, in fact, many, many countries. And in some ways, I think it punctures the narrative of an American government, and indeed the West, of being benevolent, of always striving for peace, of always looking for the best way forward for themselves or for their people. And you find countless examples, many of which have been in the press, but just a few very quick examples. The reality of Shell operating in Nigeria, which has been known for years, but essentially infiltrating the Nigerian government to make sure that Shell gets the best opportunities possible for that company, and the US being very, very aware of that. The reality of many of the Arab states, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, all dictatorships, who are encouraging the US to, or Israel for that matter, to to potentially militarily strike Iran, which is seen as a regional threat to American and Israeli hegemony. You see other examples of, for example, Australian government ministers, senior ministers, who have been very, very close and in giving information, intimate information about their political party, their government governing party, to the US embassy in Canberra. So in many ways, this sort of information, people presumed it might be happening, or you thought, well, yes, but when you see it in black and white, it reveals, I think, very much how US foreign policy works, and often it's not pretty, and often it needs to be exposed, and that's why, of course, many in the government, and many indeed in the press, who feed off that relationship, are resentful.
Yeah. Now, I read a very interesting article yesterday by Michelle Shazadovsky, who I interviewed recently on this program as well. He's from Canada. And he was pointing out that even though these WikiLeaks have come straight from government documents in the US, they are being published by the traditional media outlets, and that, for instance, the New York Times is checking with government sources all the time, and they are, in a way, captured by government sources for their leaks and information in the past. And so he was setting up a query about whether this is all absolutely kosher is the word. And could there be some intrigue still between the traditional journalists who are very close to government agencies in the United States, the Pentagon, the State Department, like David Sanger and many who write for the New York Times?
Yeah.
Or could this be absolutely independent? What would you say about that, Anthony Lowenstein?
I have actually read his piece the last few days.
Yes.
I don't generally agree, and I'll summarise very quickly. The New York Times, he is right, definitely right, when he does say that the New York Times has been in some ways very keen to check everything it's been doing with the government before it publishes.
Yep.
One of the things WikiLeaks, I think, has done, and people can think it's a good idea or a bad idea, is until this year, it's been around for 4 years now, but for the first 3 years, it refused to publish material through the mainstream press. So Julian Assange's ideology was, we're getting information, we put it on our website, people can then access it, bloggers, writers, journalists, whatever. But he got very frustrated with the fact that it wasn't getting, in his view, the kind of traction that it needed. Mm. So he therefore decided, before he released the Afghan war logs and the Iraq war logs, before the current Cablegate logs, of partnering with The Guardian, Der Spiegel, The New York Times, and a few others to release them. Now, there's no doubt that the way The Guardian has reported this compared to The New York Times is very, very different. The New York Times was very, very keen, too keen, frankly, to make sure the Obama administration was pleased or not displeased with the stuff they were releasing.
Yeah.
The Guardian did not do that. And I think the idea that by working with the mainstream press, you are by definition corrupted, some would say that. But to me, one of the things I think that WikiLeaks has shown is that simply releasing mountains of information, a huge data dump, without some analysis makes it very difficult. Now, to its credit, The Guardian also released the cables at the same time. So people can look at those and make their own assessment.
The uncensored cables, straight from the horse's mouth, yeah.
Indeed. And I think one of the strengths, though, in my view, of what The Guardian did particularly, which I think has left most of the other press for dead, is it reported many of the documents that essentially gave analysis, commentary, context. Now, some have argued that there are 250,000 cables. Only roughly 1,000 have been released thus far. And isn't it inappropriate that WikiLeaks is essentially saying, we're not going to release them all at once, we're going to release them in a staggered way, and then the public can sort of fold it, you know, in whatever order the mainstream press chooses to do it. I see that argument, and it's not an invalid point, except I would say that it doesn't really matter in the end. I mean, it implies that the mainstream press could be censoring information or not releasing stuff that might embarrass government. Now, the New York Times clearly is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of evidence to suggest that a lot of stories and angles that they are choosing is focused too obsessively and sort of covering the embarrassment of the US government by these documents coming out. The Guardian, on the other hand, I would argue, has not taken that point of view. The Guardian has reported numerous examples, a lot of the cases I reported before. One very quick point, though, I'd say, in Australia, one of the major news organisations here struck a deal with WikiLeaks, Fairfax, which is one of the major organisations here in Australia. And the problem, though, with their coverage, although lots of it's been very interesting, has been that only yesterday, in other words, a full week and a half after the first time they released the documents in their press, they released the cables themselves. And the reason they didn't do that before was the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, one of the major papers in Australia which released it, said, we didn't want to give our rivals commercial advantage. Now,
What did that mean? I don't understand.
Well, essentially what that means is that they didn't want the cables to be seen by, well, the public, I guess implied, but rivals, media rivals, because the rivals may well write stories based on them before they do.
Oh.
Now, that really, A, goes against the spirit of what WikiLeaks is doing. Ultimately, I guess you can't really force an organisation to release it. It's up to them how they do it. But I think The Guardian, to its credit, much more than anybody else, has released the cables at the same time.
The raw data.
So, indeed.
You know what occurred to me the other day, Anthony, as I was pondering this whole thing? What if some of the cables start revealing the truth about government thinking about 9/11?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Yes, most of the documents that have been released thus far are generally for the last sort of 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Some of the documents go back to 1966. There's a little bit of stuff about Indonesia and East Timor in the 70s. Thus far, at least, and as we say, only 1% have actually been released.
Yes.
There may well be stuff about 9/11. There may well be stuff about the Iraq War. I mean, it interests many people I know to find out some of the intimate details about the run-up to the Iraq War,
yeah.
The Afghan War, and potentially, which I think many of us fear, another war against, or a war against Iran.
Well, I mean, if the 9/11 documents were released, that would put the cat amongst the pigeons, so to speak. I mean, there's a huge amount that we don't know.
Absolutely.
And that was covered up and could have huge political ramifications in the United States. Anyway, that's to be seen if that happens or not. Now, give us a little background about Julian Assange, his childhood, his developmental philosophy or his philosophical attitude towards life in general, the media, the truth. Where's he coming from and who is he?
He's an Australian citizen. He is, I think he's 39 years old. He spent a lot of his life in Australia. He came from a relatively broken home. He lived in Queensland, which is the northern part of Australia. He spent many years as a hacker. He was charged in Australia about 15 years ago with hacking and ended up being released. He didn't serve any time, I don't think, only a short amount of time. He's written a number of, I guess you could say, manifestos in a way. One book called Underground, which came out in the late 1990s, which looks at the way in which the state has a relationship with information. And he comes from a position, which many people in that hacking world does, of believing that information should be far freer. There should be far less secrecy in government, and it's our responsibility as citizens to demand that information gets released. So he spent, as I said, a lot of his life in Australia, and in 2006 he launched WikiLeaks. Back then it was a pretty small website. He actually approached a number of people, including me, funnily enough, to be on the board, which I said yes, and that, for reasons I don't quite know, never quite got off the ground. But he was interested in finding individuals both in Australia and overseas to vet information that WikiLeaks was going to get, because one of the things that he believed was that the corporate press simply wasn't doing its job. The corporate press was far too close to government and power, and therefore you needed an outside force, website, whatever it would be, to sort of A, be a check on government, but also be a check on the media itself. So he he started receiving information, numerous elements of information. People often forget if they look back before this year when WikiLeaks has really taken on a whole new life of its own globally. They've actually released mountains and mountains of stuff before this year. And a few quick examples. He's released information about the guidelines for Guantanamo Bay, information about stolen elections in Kenya, information about torture in Iraq. This is well before the documents in 2010.
Mm.
And I think his philosophy seems to be someone who is an outsider. He's quite eccentric. He believes, as I said, in challenging the corporate press. I don't think he likes the press that much. Now, he's recently courted them, as I said before, for reasons people can praise or criticise, in the belief, I would argue probably correctly, probably, that he wanted to get massive exposure for this kind of material. And the simple truth is that with all its faults, and there are many, the corporate press still gets massive amounts of readership. That's the simple truth of the matter. So if you can release information and get it out in a way that he feels and the organisation feels is transparent, then why not? There's been criticism of Assange of being rather egocentric. There is, I think, a danger both before this recent controversy and now in making WikiLeaks all about one person. I think it's always a danger in having a cult figure. The recent or the current rape allegations from Sweden add a very complex level of difficulty to this situation. Without wishing to go into the great detail of that case, it's complicated, and we don't know all the facts of the case anyway, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the allegations are very suspect or politically motivated. But no one suggests, including me, he should be above the law. Far from it. But I think what's happening now is we will see a prolonged legal battle to avoid extradition, to avoid going to Sweden, to avoid going to the US. But I think ultimately that's in some ways a separate issue. It's not irrelevant. I think, unfortunately, in the press now, which is arguably what many governments would like, taking up a lot of the time and the space to talk about Assange's sex life as opposed to what WikiLeaks is actually doing, which is exactly what governments would want, of course, to smear the messenger. And we note that the allegations against Assange and what WikiLeaks is doing is not directed at the press that's reporting it. Now, there's been some calls in America for the New York Times to be prosecuted by Joe Lieberman because they've allegedly published information which is potentially treasonous, according to him. But most of the criticism of this whole recent leak has been directed at Assange, not at the press. But I think ultimately Assange is someone, people often say he's an information anarchist. I'm not quite sure if that's the right term, but he certainly believes he's very sceptical of how the corporate press does not keep checks on government power, and I would agree.
Yes, I'm interviewing Anthony Lowenstein, who's a Sydney-based journalist. So as someone recently pointed out, if they charged all politicians with the same charges of rape and sex abuse that they've charged Assange, parliaments, Congress, Senate, they would all be virtually empty.
That's a very sad state of affairs, if that's true.
Well, I mean, I know, because every time I went to Washington to lobby, you know, I was propositioned by various congressmen, not by a senator, I think, but, you know, as Henry Kissinger said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Mm. And the other thing I'd like to point out, too, is the complicity of the New York Times, for instance, in arranging the Iraq invasion by publishing articles by Judith Miller.
Indeed.
Five front-page articles saying that there was absolute evidence that those aluminium tubes were for processing of uranium and that then Iraqi had weapons of mass destruction. So in truth, although the New York Times has kind of apologised, it in fact helped to organise the invasion of Iraq. And the other thing I would say is that the media is totally complicit now or compliant with government in that they embedded the journalists. So the journalists went within the tanks and within the troops to invade Iraq and so got a terribly biased point of view and their stories were censored by the Pentagon. So I think just from that perspective that Julian Assange is doing a very noble thing.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I'd also say one thing, just to add to that point, the embedding process of actually having guests in tanks is, on the one hand, very effective from the government's perspective, but I think it's also a question of, it's also an embedded mindset as well.
Yes.
That so many journalists love being close to power. They love being close to important people and getting supposedly important information. That, I think, is the key problem. And I think the issue also is there's little transparency, for example, in how that works, in how those relationships work, in how journalists often are taken on many free trips to various places.
Yeah.
And there's no acknowledgement about how that works. And what I should point out with Judith Miller, she's had on one level a remarkable transformation. She was at the New York Times, as you rightly said. She was then let go by the Times, but her co-writer on those stories was Michael Gordon. And Michael Gordon still thrives at the New York Times. And Judith Miller now has a new career working for Fox News and the Wall Street Journal often. So her career, you could argue, took a slight dip, but is now back on track from her perspective anyway.
Yeah, there's an interesting story about Judith Miller. I knew her, and I went to brief the editorial board of the New York Times several times, and she was there, and they called her Judy. She was obviously, well, they were quite affectionate towards her, and she was really part of the scene. So anyway, that's another story. Let's think, where do we go from here? I also have been reading the papers in Australia about Julian Assange, and he grew up on an island on the Barrier Reef called Magnetic Island with his mother. And I don't know if he actually knows who his father is, but they were in a kind of a cult. And so he grew up in a rather eccentric way. And it's interesting now his mother has appeared at the court in Britain. She flew over from Australia. And apparently she looks young, fresh, tanned, and is an interesting woman. And you can see kind of where he comes from an altruistic perspective and a different perspective. And, of course, society needs that. And as well as probably having an assessed IQ of about 170, which is just vast, he's using his intelligence in ways that is that are terribly important. Because if you look at what he's done, he's opened up the whole book for us to look at about the way governments, including our own in Australia, Anthony, use our tax dollars but work behind closed doors, setting up wars, using our money, working with corporations and the like that we really don't understand, and they actually have absolutely no right to do that. Would you like to comment on that?
I do agree with that, and that's, of course, why the Australian government and, of course, the American government, in fact, most governments, apart from, I think, Bolivia and Venezuela and a handful of others, are so outraged and are trying to find a way to silence WikiLeaks. We shouldn't forget that a few days after these leaks were released, the Australian government, Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister of Australia, came out and said very publicly that Julian Assange was doing illegal things and should be prosecuted. Now, when she was asked again about that a few days later, what crimes has he broken, she couldn't name anything. And in fact, here we are 2 weeks into this current situation, and she still can't, because there are no laws that have been broken. And I think one of the things that you see in the US as well about this coverage is that it's framed very much in a post-9/11 way, that any kind of revelations or peeling back the mask of how the US works or Australia works is helping our enemies. It's helping terrorists essentially, you know, get us from the inside, that Assange is essentially, as he's been accused of in the US, a cyber terrorist. And we shouldn't forget that the rhetoric that's been directed at Assange in the US has really been quite extraordinary, not just from fringe players. I mean, we're talking about senior major politicians, potential presidents of America. I hate to say Sarah Palin, but she may well be president one day.
Yes, definitely.
Talking openly about assassination. We're talking about senior Fox News correspondents talking about drone strikes on Assange. And this is the kind of level a rhetoric. And of course, what's astounding is there's no payback for that. You can say that kind of thing openly, and no one, you know, blinks an eye. Simply, it's okay, supposedly, in a post 9/11 world, to talk openly about assassinating people you don't like, and everyone just goes, "Oh well, that's just the way it is now." And that rhetoric. So therefore, Assange rightfully fears for his life. He's currently in a jail in solitary confinement in Britain, and hopefully would be released on bail later on this week. But I think one of the things that also becomes very clear is that I, like as a journalist, is that it shows what independent press could do. And what I mean by that very briefly is that although he's working with corporate press now, he very much has shown, and although people have thought about it before, Julian Assange, of course, but he's shown it on a massive scale, how it is possible to release information which embarrasses governments to insulate yourself from criticism. What I mean by that is that independent press has a major role to play in, for example, doing similar things to what he does. Websites like that. I mean, every country could do a great deal from a site like WikiLeaks to get information that's important. Not necessarily always, major political acts, it may be smaller issues, but there's no doubt that Assange has shown a model in a way of how this can be done. He's probably made mistakes, and there can be things that could be done differently, and people will learn from those mistakes in his tactics, etc. But he's been a trailblazer in that way, and I think what governments are worried about, which is why they're so keen to silence him, is not realising that with the internet, you really can't put the genie back in the bottle. I mean, ultimately, what I think, and I found this in my Blogging Revolution book, many governments around the world, including in the West, don't realise the internet is not like a newspaper. You can shut down a website, you can put someone in jail, you can try and silence them. But we saw with WikiLeaks, as one quick example, that when there were serious attempts and massive pressures to silence that website last week, within about 2 hours, there were 1,000 mirror sites around the world by countless supporters. So in other words, unless you shut down the entire internet, which won't happen because the economies would crash now in the world, the truth is that WikiLeaks and what it stands for, whether it's WikiLeaks or another website similar, cannot be killed. And that, I think, is the real fear that many journalists have and politicians have, that WikiLeaks could disappear tomorrow, Assange could be put in jail tomorrow for 50 years, God forbid, but ultimately other people have seen how it's done. And the importance, I think, of that is that, or the danger, I suppose, also, is that some people have criticised their release in the last few weeks, saying, well, the result will be that government's now going to be more secretive, the government's going to be less open. And in the short term, that's potentially true. Who knows? Who knows? But at the same time, people have also seen how important it is to release this information. And let me just close very quickly on this point, that Daniel Ellsberg, the obviously famous Pentagon Papers leaker, said for many years before this recent controversy, almost begging in a way, for American soldiers, intelligence officers, someone in the US government to leak information about 9/11, about the Iraq war, about the Afghan war, to show Americans and the world what exactly went wrong, why it happened, the lies, etc. And until Bradley Manning, who is allegedly the US soldier or intelligence officer who released this information, and Assange, who helped him or released it to the world, there haven't been that many people, and there has been an absence of bravery. Now, at the same time, of course, Manning is facing lifetime in jail. The guy is 25. He's facing 50 years jail plus. And that's, of course, an attempt to try and say to other people who might be considering it, if you release information, we're going to put you in jail for the rest of your life. But the hope is that people see Manning, and I think he's often been ignored in the last few weeks. He, in some ways, if he's the one who did it, and we don't know for sure, is a hero, because he saw what America was doing and thought it had to be told. And I suspect, in fact, we know, there are many Americans in the establishment who feel the same way, but haven't quite got to the point of getting it out there. And I guess I would encourage anyone who thinks about doing that, obviously there's a very high price to pay. No one can underestimate that. But You could argue that Bradley Manning is doing the most patriotic thing imaginable by doing what he's done, if he's the one who did it.
Mm-hmm. And he'll go down in history as a historical figure.
Indeed.
I'm interviewing Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney, Australian-based journalist who's written for many publications around the world. So, leading on from what you've just discussed, Anthony, there are probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of young, usually men, some of them have Asperger's syndrome,
yeah,
who are absolutely brilliant. I mean, if I have a problem with my computer or iPhone or anything, I just go straight to my grandson, who understands it. They understand this technology right from their very earliest years, and they know how to hack and get into systems.
Mm.
And so governments might tend to be more secretive in their diplomatic cables, as my brother, who was an ambassador, Richard Bronowski, says. Maybe they might have to go back to diplomatic pouches now and send material via mail rather than by the internet to make it secret. But it really shows that nothing on the internet now can be secret. And I wonder, it's just an evolving, it's an evolutionary process. I wonder where it's going to lead democracy, governments, and the way they operate and how they interdigitate with the corporations of the world who really run the whole show. It's really quite fascinating. And I would add one more thing, that the internet was invented by the Pentagon to survive a nuclear war so that the military could communicate with each other after a nuclear war. So people.
It's ironic in the extreme, isn't it? Ironic in the extreme.
Absolutely.
I think one of the things that's fascinating about the web is that, and the danger, and I think many people who, including me, who talk about issues of web freedom, is that there is growing pressure, not just in places like China or Iran, where you expect internet censorship and it's there and it's getting worse and people know about it, but there's increasing pressure in the West, in the US, in Australia and elsewhere, to censor the internet.
But can it be censored, really?
Well, people say, look at China, and they say, to the extent that a lot of information is not available, yes, you can, if you have a massive infrastructure, which is what China has, with the assistance, I might add, of Google, Yahoo and Microsoft and Cisco, who are all Western companies. You can censor the internet. You can, to an extent, for example, put a system in place whereby you type in certain things into a search engine, Google or something else, and only certain things come out. You can have what China has something called a 50-cent army, which is literally hundreds of thousands of Chinese people who whose job, and they get paid 50 cents per comment, to go onto online sites and comment, to put pro-government comments on, you know, sites, whatever. Now, that's not in a self-censorship, but that's more controlling the conversation. One of the big issues, of course, in America is the issue of net neutrality, which I'm sure some of your listeners will be aware of.
What does it mean?
Net neutrality, in its simplest form, is there's a desire by many corporations to have a two-tier internet system. So if you have a lot of money, you can basically pay up and get a very fast internet with good access. If you can't, you get a slow internet and much slower access. And the corporations are saying, well, why shouldn't we, who provide the infrastructure and put all this money into the internet, why shouldn't we be able to charge more for users who can afford it? Now, the problem, of course, is that inevitably the opponents of that kind of reality, including me and many others in the States, say that a two-tier internet is exactly the opposite of what the internet should be, that it should be open to all, there should be access to all, there should be no choice between those who can afford it and those who cannot. That's not so much censorship as much as an attempt to try and impose some kind of very clear class system on the web. There's no doubt, though, that in the last few years, and again, 9/11 has been central to this, that many prominent US senators, and you see this in other countries too, talk about the idea of censoring information on the web, in their view, which endorses terrorism, this catch-all phrase that means everything and nothing. And what that would mean potentially is that, for example, and I often talk about this, Hamas or Hezbollah, two good examples. There are major movements in the Middle East. Some people love them, some people hate them. But the truth is they have massive support in the Middle East. They're both elected, which we shouldn't forget, in Palestine and in Lebanon. But in many Western countries, they're regarded as a terrorist organization. They are in America, they are in Australia. And there's been moves for a number of years, and this is only increasing, of saying that citizens in, say, New York or Sydney should not be allowed to access the websites of those groups because they're a terrorist group and we shouldn't have the right to access terrorist information. Now, the problem, of course, with this is, on the one hand, self-evident, that A, these organizations are arguably not terrorist organizations, which is a debate one can have some other time, but they are organizations and institutions that speak for many, many people, and therefore should we not have the right to at least see what they're saying? One of the problems, as I'm sure many listeners will be well aware of from your show, is that the problem from post-9/11 from American foreign policy has solely been that Islam is only seen in one way. There's good Islam and there's bad Islam. There's good Muslims and there's bad Muslims. And any Muslim organization who sees themselves as an Islamist, I'm not defending a lot of terrible behavior that's gone on in the Arab world, far from it, but the US's view of Islam has been so narrow, so blind by ideology about saying that only one view of Islam is acceptable, one that's pro-US, that they are excluding so many Muslims around the world who may well be interested in engaging with America or at least talking. And I'm just a bit off the track, but my point being that there are moves to censor websites that promote those kind of views.
But can they be censored? That's the point.
In a simple term, the answer is yes.
How?
You can.
How?
Well, like in China, you can make certain websites inaccessible. You can.
Yeah, but the Chinese are very clever young hackers. They get into most systems, don't they?
They do.
Even though there's censorship.
Indeed. I should say you can censor it, but there are always ways around.
Yeah.
There's always ways around. There are.
And we're dealing with highly intelligent young people.
True. But we shouldn't also underestimate that one of the reasons for censorship is more to make people fearful of going to those sites. That's one of the great challenges.
Well, what fear could be aroused by going to a
Monitoring of where the sites are being accessed, depending on where the sites are.
And then what would happen if you, in fact, monitored a censor site?
Well, for example, briefly, in Iran and China, if you are going to an internet cafe, and many individuals can't afford their own computers, so they go to a massive internet cafe, they're all monitored. The computers themselves are monitored. The centers themselves are monitored. People can see what you're looking at. Now, I'm not suggesting in China and Iran people aren't looking at so-called covert websites. They do all the time. But there's no doubt that, for example, in Iran, in the last year and a half, since there's been a massive crackdown by Ahmadinejad's government, a very brutal crackdown, that the dissent that existed in Iran, web dissent, although it's there, it's massively reduced. There's no question about that. And for the reasons very clear, people are scared. People are scared by the massive show of force by the regime against any dissidents. And this is not to suggest there's not dissent. There is. I follow it. I read it. There are bloggers and writers who still, mostly anonymously now, write
in Iran
in this kind of way. And again, I'm not suggesting America is Iran or whatever. It's not. But in many ways, I think initially there was a sense that there are two ways to see the internet. The so-called free world, America, Australia and Europe, and the so-called repressive world, China, Iran, and other countries. And although that's generally still true, increasingly I think many Western governments, although they don't acknowledge this, I think look at a place like China and Iran, and they some, not all, and say, well, maybe there are some good ideas over there. And I think what you see with WikiLeaks, the kind of coalitions that are forming to defend it, in some ways don't entirely ignore the left-right political divide. But they, in Australia, for example, in the US and in England, there are some from the left, libertarian right, some from the centre, the web community, the free speech community, etc., etc. Not particularly clearly left and right, which I think is a good thing.
Well, it's very interesting. I'm interviewing Anthony Lowenstein, a Sydney-based journalist in Australia. what we're talking about, well, first of all, number one, the extraordinary power of the corporations and the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex. I mean, they run the whole thing. And if you look at the boards of various institutes, organizations, corporations, people interdigitate and sit on many boards, like Catherine Graham, who ran the Washington Post.
Yeah.
She sat on many boards, and that was just an example. So that the power is enormous, and they want to maintain their position of superiority, especially as the rich are getting richer and richer and richer and richer now in America, take for example, and they'll maintain that at any cost. So if you take the example of Iran and China and the crackdown there on the internet and the threat that hackers now pose to those corporations and the powers that be, particularly in the United States, who actually run the world through globalization and the GTO, then they may, and there are intimations of that, take Iran as an example, as you said, and see it as a way to control their present status and turn a democracy into a police state in a way. I think we need to understand the very profound abnormalities that could occur in society and be ready to, I suppose, fight them. This is a sort of two sides coming together in an unholy clash down the time track. Would you agree with that?
I would, and I think we shouldn't forget that, for example, Assange has said, although who knows what this schedule will be like now because of his incarceration, but he has documents that are allegedly, he claims, about one of the major US banks. We don't know which one. We think Bank of America, although we don't know that for sure, that he claims could bring down the bank. Now, that's maybe rather melodramatic, we don't know, but certainly incriminating documents about a major, major US bank. And I suppose one of the things that becomes quite clear, and you see this in how corporations have reacted, we shouldn't forget that last week, MasterCard and Visa and PayPal and Amazon, all major US corporations, essentially buckled to US government pressure, not much pressure, I might add, to exclude WikiLeaks. Assange has said this week that it's clear that those organizations are therefore tools of US foreign policy. There are now growing calls, although difficult because they're pretty major, to boycott those organizations, to make them aware of how they behave. And we shouldn't forget that when Google in 2006 made a very clear decision to go into China and censor its search engine, Google had a massive backlash. Now, the company didn't fall and still exists and whatever. But in the end, there was a very, very bad stench that emanated from Google about its behavior, that essentially it was colluding with the Chinese regime. And in the end, although it's still doing that now, it's tried to kind of soften that a little bit and not make it quite as bad as before. I'm not defending Google's behavior at all, but there is certainly a realization that public opinion does matter. And I think many corporations simply act as if the public doesn't exist. In other words, people are always going to access Amazon because, you know, it's the biggest bookstore in the world. And yes, Amazon is an amazing website that has lots of great stuff, of course. And, you know, but one doesn't have to use Amazon. One doesn't have to use PayPal. You know, many of us use PayPal, have used PayPal to access money online. There are alternatives to that. So I think there is a realization in the last few weeks, if it didn't exist before, for many citizens that those corporations, who I might add, buckled without any evidence. With Amazon, it was made very clear, or PayPal, they received a call. It will come out. They received a call being told, WikiLeaks is doing something terrible. You guys really, if you know yourself well, shouldn't be supporting them by hosting them or whatever. And they buckled very, very quickly because they were petrified, I guess, of getting offside with the US government. People noticed that, and I think there has been a growing online campaign to target those companies. And we shouldn't forget that in the days after that happened, what we now are in the middle of is a very strange new development, which is kind of like a cyber war in a way. And what's happening is, and it's getting a bit of press, but not as much as it should, is that many hackers around the world who are pro-WikiLeaks are saying, well, if you guys as a corporation are going to behave that way and shut down the right of free speech, try to shut down WikiLeaks, we're going to close down your website. The Guardian editorial a few days ago talked about how when hackers are trying to just bring down a website, is that simply the new form of civil disobedience? In other words, many of these hackers, and I'm not saying I agree with this, but many hackers would say, our aim is not to destroy Amazon. Our aim is simply to say, as civil disobedience is, your website's inaccessible for one day, or you can't access Visa for a day. And the Guardian editorial was saying they didn't condemn it. They said there are obviously ways it can get out of control where essentially one side does one thing, then one side does something back, and that can escalate potentially quite dangerously. And that's what's happening now, that the lead story in The Independent in London on Monday was that the British government was worried that depending on what happened to Julian Assange in his court case that following day, that hackers may well target the British government websites, the Defence Department and others, as retaliation. And the fact that there's an ability to do so by those in the West, as opposed to what's happened in the past, as WikiLeaks has shown, where the Chinese government or certainly proxies of the Chinese government are attempting to get information from the Defence Department website, from the Pentagon, or bring them down for a short period of time. Now you have a situation where there are activists or online figures or hackers or call them whatever you want who are interested in showing corporations up. Now, what people think about that kind of behaviour is an interesting discussion. I think there's something to be said for that, that you could argue that it shows that these corporations can be reached. They're not above, not above the law, I should say, but they're not above being reached by average citizens. Now, how people feel about, you know, websites being hacked into is a different debate. But the argument that is this civil disobedience of the 21st century is something worth considering.
Yeah. Well, the power of the internet is extraordinary because almost all people now in Western nations and others have except the developing nations, have access to the internet. So it's incredibly powerful. And I want to lead from what you've just said onto something else, which worries the hell out of me. We know that both Russia and America have thousands of hydrogen bombs on missiles, on hair trigger alert, with a three-minute decision time by either Putin or Obama to release them by accident, by computer design. My question is, and it really does freak the hell out of me, what can the Chinese hackers, for instance, or some irresponsible kids, can they get into the Pentagon early warning system or the Russian early warning system? Because all these weapons are under computer control.
Yeah. Well,
tell us.
The simple answer is I don't know.
Yeah.
That's obviously the honest answer. There is no doubt that the WikiLeaks cable dump in the last few weeks has shown that, and of course we don't know what else is going to be on there, that the Chinese government, or certainly proxies of the Chinese government, have accessed quite deep into very top-secret US government areas. Not, as far as we know, nuclear codes or anything like that, as far as we know.
But we don't know, do we?
We don't know. And of course I suspect that the US government wouldn't be announcing that tomorrow on the front page of the New York Times.
But how can they protect these sites? I mean, these kids are so brilliant. I mean, they're the brilliant ones who who set up the internet in the first place and have produced the computers. And so they're the insiders. It's like a surgeon, knowing so much that he could destroy the patient on the operating table and no one really understood it, but yes, only he does.
Look, as I said, the simple, honest answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that the fact that now we can even imagine the fact that it is possible, as you rightly say, is bloody worrying.
Why aren't people writing about it, Anthony? I mean, it seems to me that the end of life on Earth might be a fairly top priority for many newspapers.
Well, maybe. I guess it might affect their bottom line a little bit, yes. Look, I honestly can't. I don't know, Helen. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't tell you the answer. I mean, I've certainly mentioned it here and there in passing, and maybe I should have given more attention
than
I have.
Yes, I think you really should. I think that always should be mentioned in any conversation or interview that you have, Anthony Lowenstein, That possibility must always be brought up. Number one and number two, of course, all the nuclear power plants are on computer control as well. And we know that the Americans made a worm called Stuxnix that they injected into the computer systems of the Iranian, I think, uranium enrichment facilities. Yeah. So you see, you can, to use an Australian expression, which Americans won't like, you can bugger up anything.
Yes, indeed. Well, that that computer worm allegedly came from Israel, although, of course, we don't
did
know.
It?
And,
oh, right.
Well, again, there's no, I can't prove that. Yeah. But, I mean, it seems, stuff I've read about that, it probably came from Israel or the US.
Actually, I've read that too.
And, yes, apparently it was an incredibly, from their perspective, very effective virus. It essentially has supposedly affected the Iranian nuclear program, set it back minorly, God knows what the actual details of that. It hasn't really been released, but there is certainly an ability to do that. Now, of course, you could argue that it's much better doing that than bombing Iran. Now, I'm not suggesting it's that choice, but the problem is that many people, including myself, fear that the idea of a military strike on Iran for Iran's alleged nuclear weapons capability, which, dare I say, has never been proven, is seriously on the cards. And there's no doubt that the idea of the Obama administration stopping Israel from doing it seems like a pretty of a, I wouldn't have much faith that they would do that. And WikiLeaks, in fact, has shown that there has been serious pressure from Israel on the US and indeed from the Arab countries to bomb Iran, ideally today or tomorrow. No one's talking about an invasion, just a good old sort of bombing run. And the concern of that is self-evident, I suppose, but that it would, if people who argue that should be happening have a hope that that'll bring the Iranian people to rise up against their regime, the opposite, in fact, will happen. The opposite, which is obvious to many of us. And even when I was there a few years ago speaking to many Iranians who hated the government, hated them with a passion, said the day the West bombs our country, Israel or America or anyone else, people rally around the government, which is sort of self-evident, but needs to be said. And I guess the connection to what you were talking about with the nuclear question is that you mentioned before about how the New York Times was essentially a mouthpiece for the Iraq war, and I'd agree with that. In many ways, I think the New York Times learned no lessons whatsoever from that, because much of its reporting about Iran and its so-called nuclear capability is no different. It is generally filled with anonymous sourcing from U.S. government officials or other officials talking about the growing Iranian threat, so to speak. Same journalists, apart from Judy Miller, Michael Gordon, David Sanger, and others. And the problem with that, again, is self-evident, but there is no accountability. It's as if the press either has permanent amnesia, which is possible, but I think it's more pernicious than that.
Yeah.
I think it's the sense that they see their role as generally mirroring U.S. foreign policy. And I've often found, I read the New York Times every day for my sins.
So do I.
But I just read it because I feel it gives me a good insight into how the U.S. government thinks, basically. Especially under a so-called liberal Democrat president, liberal in the very loose term of the word. But I think the issue just finally on the nuclear question is that we've seen even this week the Australian Foreign Minister, Kevin Rudd, who's hardly someone who believes in wonderful human rights, who says that Israel, who clearly has got nuclear weapons, should have to have it inspected by the IAEA. Now, Israel's not very pleased with that, and it seems, on the one hand, utterly uncontroversial to say so, really, but it's not going to happen anytime
soon. Well, he's the only one who ever, since Golda Meir and Nixon formed an agreement to neither confirm nor deny Israeli's nuclear arsenal, only one ever to come out and say it has one and there should be inspectors there. And I just want to end on one point, Anthony Lowenstein. Mm. Physicians for Social Responsibility did a study several years ago and worked out if Israel dropped two small nuclear weapons on the three uranium facilities in Iran, the fallout would be such that it could kill up to 1 million people of acute radiation illness and cancer all the way over to Pakistan. So we mustn't forget that these that we're playing with absolute fire, the fire of the gods, the fire of the stars. And on that note, we have to end, Anthony. I want to thank you so much for this really fascinating interview. No doubt there will be further developments, and we will come back and interview you again if we may.
No, thank you so much. I enjoyed it, and I'm happy to come on anytime.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Anthony. Today on If You Love This Planet, I've been interviewing Anthony Lowenstein, who's a Sydney-based journalist, has written for many publications around the world, including The Guardian, Haaretz, The Nation, Sydney Morning Herald, and many others. He has a best-selling book called My Israel Question and a 2008 book called The Blogging Revolution. I'm sure you found it absolutely fascinating today. We're entering totally new territory for the human race and all other species on Earth, may I say. We will be back with you next week with another fascinating program. In the meantime, stay tuned. If you want more information, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you want to help us, we would be very grateful. There is a page to donate money for the program. Thank you again. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.